A warm welcome to this podcast episode on leadership and kintsugi in a world that feels broken. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, known by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the town of Gummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge, to develop themselves and their organizations, and to explore liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. My name is Clinton de Priam, and in today's episode, we're exploring the Japanese art of kintsugi and what we can learn from it as leaders, especially in this time where our world and its systems feel extremely complicated and perhaps even broken. I am, as always, excited to be joined by my dear colleague and friend, Marike Groenewald, as co-host in today's conversation. Hello, Marike.
Hello, Clinton, and hello, everybody. And it is my enormous pleasure to welcome to this conversation today, Motoki Ton. Hello, Motoki.
Hello.
It's so great having you with us. As I was thinking about how I want to introduce you in our conversation today and looking at all the work you've done and reading a bit about you, I thought two words came to mind for me. The one is that it seems like you've got a real heart for leadership. You're a founder, you're a specialist in organizational culture. You're somebody that thinks a lot about mindful leadership. We're going to talk about some of the Japanese philosophies that you've thought about, written about, speak about. But you're also a creative spirit and a creative soul. So I came across some of your photography online. And it feels to me like you're somebody that brings kind of these two streams together, creativity and a real spirit for leadership contribution in the world. So I just want to welcome you to our conversation and thank you for being with us today. And as Clinton said, we are talking today about kintsugi. And I don't want to say anything about it because I want to leave you to put the language to this concept, this part of Japanese culture, Japanese philosophy. And I was hoping you could introduce it to us, but also perhaps tell us a bit about your link to it. Because you, as I've said, you write about it, you speak about it, you've developed metaphors around it, leadership programs around it, facilitate for it. So what does it mean for you and how does it link to your own story?
Well, thank you for that warm welcome. I already feel at home in this conversation. And this is like also speaking to my Japanese spirit, maybe hospitality. I think you are experts. That's why I stumbled on you as well, on your work. Very inspirational for me. And maybe this is also one way to get to kintsugi. I was thinking when you spoke about the work and kintsugi, maybe there's something, sometimes there's brokenness in the world, but there's also beauty. And so I think kintsugi plays a central role to how we find aesthetics and beauty in the world, because this world is so beautiful. And at the same time, it's so fragile. And this brought me, I guess, to kintsugi. And when you spoke about the creativity and all the things I could do in my life, photography was maybe a way to display this beauty in the world, also the fragility. And and then I think as leaders, when you talked about leadership, I think it's taking responsibility for that, to really balance that. And this is where the metaphor of kintsugi can play really a valuable role and bringing us also narrative to explore this balance of, you know, beauty, fragility, and sometimes things do break in our lives and, you know, in our beings, but also in our relationships.
Did you stumble upon it? I mean, there's a clue in your name, I think, about how it maybe come to be in your life. But what drew you to it so intensely and so much that you're working with it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was always drawn to Japanese culture. My mother is Japanese. She grew me up mostly alone in my life. I was raised up in Germany most of my time. So I was in Germany and, you know, immersed by this German culture. And sometimes when I got to Japan, I thought like, oh, this is normal here. Things that I found weird in Germany sometimes in terms of culture and behavior or how we engage with each other. In Japan, this is just normal. And of course, the other way around as well. And so I always was reminded there is something in me potentially that is, you know, close to Japanese culture. And over the course of my life, now I'm 51, I always had some times where I really investigated those things. Mm. And when I saw the first time I saw a kintsugi piece, I was so drawn by it. And there was not much on the internet. Today, you will find articles on National Geographic and so on about kintsugi. At that time, it was really rare. And sometimes when there's something really special, something really rare, it just gets my interest. And so I got some funding from a foundation, and we could fly to Japan to document a kintsugi artist, which was amazing.
Wow.
But at that time, like 10, 12 years ago, I was so naive about all this. I was really super naive about this. And then really later on, I found the really depth of the process of repairing and the whole, yeah, the narrative that really developed later. And now I think you can find a lot of resources about kintsugi online these days, even some great books about it. Yeah, but this is years later now.
I was trying to, when we went through this conversation, I was trying to think, when was the first time that I saw kintsugi in action, you know, a video of someone meticulously repairing. I have to also say, I have a mild obsession with a teacup. So it makes me extremely, it makes me excited to see that someone would pay so much attention to fixing something like a teacup when you think like, oh, this thing is broken. And then this next life comes from it that you didn't think was possible. And it's somehow more beautiful than the original piece, because now I feel like it has a story also with it. If we turn our focus to the IAF and leadership specifically and its task or its goal of developing leaders in the world, and we bring in kintsugi, what are the parallels or the links that you see between leadership development or developing leaders in this day and age and kintsugi, specifically when there's so much transformation and brokenness and crises in the world?
I mean, I think an invitation could be to follow your route, because you mentioned your precious, like, or your relationship to the teacup, right? So kintsugi maybe is coming from the even more traditional idea of the tea, the way of the tea. No, it's like an old art form, which Japan also acquired from China and developed then their own, you know, Zen idea of it, and also their own tradition, maybe today even a secular tradition of tea. So one idea would be if we would meet in person, whether it's in South Africa, you know, whether it's in Berlin, this would be a special meeting for us. And to really display this, you know, special occasion and to give space, time, you know, even meaning, we could start with a tea ceremony. Why not? You know, I'm not a tea ceremony master, but we would find ways to do that. And one way is to really honor the moment, the present moment of this meeting. And the teacup could be one way to really bring this into gestalt, right? So if you would come to my house, I could use ordinary, you know, teacups, which I acquired at IKEA or somewhere, you know. But also I have friends who are into ceramics, and they're quite masterful with that. And so each cup would be unique. So there's a quality of uniqueness also into our meeting. And I would think, oh, which cup could, you know, not fit, but, you know, would inspire Clinton, for example. And this is also test trying, you know, just assuming maybe, and then when seeing changing the side of the cup and looking at it, a little bit of really giving space. With Marika the same, maybe it would speak to you, the cup, would tell a story. And then there's our moments. So there are three cups involved, and there's tea involved, and moments of pause and thinking and valuing the moment. And maybe if I could think of, this is an invitation, so if you guys come to here to my home, I would say, oh, this has been so special. Why don't you take the cup with you? right? And so the cup would travel, which is amazing for me. Like, it would be amazing if you take the cup home to you, to your space, right? They would tell the further story at your space. Mm. And then, you know, Japan has this special location, you know, where why we have so many earthquakes in Japan. Over 1,000 maybe a year, if you calculate the light ones and the, say, more medium, even heavy ones on the scale. And so that's why things break in Japan, like literally, you know. Every school kid is trained, you know, multiple times a month. They have training what happens if an earthquake appears, right? So you gather, you collect yourself under the table, and this is like really normal, you know? And it's so inhabited in the culture, but still things break.
Mm.
And what happens if your teacup at home would break and you think of this moment, oh, this was the time when we were together, we're free, you know? Does it mean that your memory to this unique occasion will break? Or are there other ways? And that's where kintsugi comes into. So it's a really, like you said, a really diligent, a process that requires a lot of patience. And then something new can come out of it, which still displays the old. So it takes forth the memory. But also it's kind of a new creation. It's a new kind of art itself and can speak a further story. And so I think it combines the tea ceremony because it works with ceramics mostly. But also the tea metaphor is a bigger metaphor. It's not just about drinking tea. I think a lot of people may notice that. But it's really making space and time. And so, no, I think you may think, or whoever hears this way think, what does this tell me about leadership? It's like making space. It's more about doing a tea ceremony is more facilitating the ceremony over hours, maybe 3 hours, 4 hours. A lot of space is involved. A lot of, today we would say maybe mindfulness, you know, a lot of becoming aware of the quality which is in the room. And then also dealing with this fragility as well, but also the beauty that lies in the world.
There's so many threads I can pull on in that. There's the beauty of making time and space. There's also an element of thoughtfulness and purposeness, if I can make my own words. The idea of thinking specifically, you know, what is the teacup that Clinton would like for this particular occasion? There's a specificity to it that I think demonstrates care and thoughtfulness and interest and genuine attention given to a particular meeting, a particular gathering. That feels so contradictory to the time where we live in, where, you know, we love making templates of everything. We love making standard operating procedures so that it's easier for us. We don't have to think about it again next time. We can just copy paste. So there's that element of it. Then there's this beautiful link between the geography of Japan and the almost always ready state of or a state of readiness at an earthquake that can happen any moment, and that something will break. There's almost a sense of acceptance that something like this will happen in future, and our response is not to try and preserve that which already exists, but to try and fix it or to make something new of it. And this breaking, if we think about leaders that often in their positions receive a lot of criticism, they try things, they fail. How do you, what do you think leaders can learn from this idea of repair, of restoring, of trying something, but then fixing it and making something new out of it? What can we draw from that?
I think I would start with the personal level. Maybe this is the invitation here. So when I was 17, 18, I had an accident. And since that, my leg is like fully filled with, my right leg is really filled with scars. You know, in the beginning, in my youth, I was like, in summer, I was, even Germany, we have summer, right? So I was wearing long, you know, trousers because I didn't want to show them. No, I even didn't want to have a conversation about them. But later on, I would not say I'm proud of these, but I'm now really more relaxed and I have more incorporated the story of these stars. And I think if we look at leadership, you know, when we look at what Brené Brown brings into this world, you know, about, you know, armored leadership or leadership which comes from a place of vulnerability, we even have studies that show, you know, if we free talk about all our successes and accomplishments in our lives on an empathy level, how deeply can we connect? Or if we talk also about the things that didn't went well, or the things we were challenged, or even where we had like what we call failures, you know, then we would connect on a total other level, right? And so the science of empathy, I think even in teams, now coming to the collective, because I think leadership always takes place where people are, you know, still this times of AI, it's still, you know, there are people involved. It really builds psychological safety, right? And this is a starting point for creativity and for unusual ideas and for questioning the status quo. So all the things such in terms of creativity, innovation, and maybe also it's a question of how do I see myself as a leader? So if I'm more facilitating these days, it more brings this quality of serving, maybe a servant leadership into it, rather than I have all the answers, you know, everything has been, every decision has go through my desk, kind of. And as you said, I really love the word, like having a genuine interest in people. I think people also sense that, you know, you can feel your own curiosity or you're really interested on, you know, how people will feel. And I think what I love, as you named this, Marika, is like mindful leadership, you know, it brings a little bit the idea of a pause into our doing and more acting from a being, you know, than rather than I define my leadership by my doing and by my accomplishments. So invites us leader, I would say in a nutshell, to do the also the inner work. And then from that point, start whatever you have to do as a leader or whatever you would say comes next.
I'm busy reading a book at the moment. Clinton is used to these moments in conversations where I reference whatever book I'm busy reading at the moment. It's called Unreasonable Hospitality. I don't know whether you've read it, Motoki, by an author, Will Guidara. The byline of the book is something like the remarkable power of giving people more than they expect. And it comes from the restaurant industry, where this man built an entire empire on service and giving people more than they expect. So one of the stories that he tells is of a couple being in the restaurant having dinner for the anniversary and saying to the waiter, "We forgot the bottle of champagne in our fridge at home. Would you mind pausing our service so that my husband can go home and take the bottle out of the fridge because it's going to explode, out of the freezer?" And the waiter says to them, "Don't worry." And he decides he's going to go to their home, take the bottle out of their freezer, put it in the fridge. And when they get home, the restaurant left for them a cheese platter, a little box of chocolates, an anniversary note to enjoy their evening. And this is one of many examples in the book, but one of the principles that he talks about is, and this is where I get back to our conversation now, is this idea of intentionality, that no detail is too small. And if you want to be an intentional leader in the world, you have to cultivate the practice of slowing down, noticing the detail, and acting on it from your own values. And I think that's what's so powerful for me about what you're saying, and reminds me how hard it is to slow down. To slow down, first and foremost, to notice the big things and the small things that you want to act on, and to then choose an appropriate response that says something about your leadership. Clinton and I often think about this idea of thoughtfulness, which I think is another word that we use for intentionality. And I was just wondering what you think about that. And, you know, it always feels to me a little bit, it a little bit easy to go, okay, but you know, if you build in a kintsugi practice in your daily life, then that'll teach you how to slow down. I don't think that's how it works for everybody. But how do we cultivate the practice of countering this incredible series of waves that is life at the moment, and return to intentionality and thoughtfulness as a means to activate our way of being as leaders?
Oh, there's so much into it. First, if you want to get me broke, like, and just name interesting books, I will buy them immediately. And I saw that book, by the way. I saw that book. I just went into hospitality. And then it was recommended. I saw the book, but I didn't buy it yet. And I think it's a great example that you name, because, I mean, if you look at the repair process, it's really an unreasonable amount of effort that is going into repair such a thing. But at the same time, maybe it's not, because this means something to somebody, whether it's the artist of the pottery, whether it's you know, and it has all the story. And in terms of efficiency, of course, it's easier, you know, just to throw it away and then buy a new one. It's like done in 5 seconds on Amazon. And this is the world we kind of designed. We all designed this world, right? Where we are so efficient in everything. Whether it's finding a partner online, you know, whether it's looking up a leadership talk online, whether it's buying something online. So we're like so much into it. And I would say, then it's just a big invitation to find a counterculture. Yeah. If we just don't want to pursue the efficient way, because on the efficient way, I'm not sure if we are winning this human game that we're into it also. You know, we're burning like 3 times the earth at the moment and all these questions, right? So really pausing. And then kintsugi is a metaphor for that. And if you're new to the topic and you're just looking up now some things, it's easy to fall into a lot of traps when you look into kintsugi, and I did it myself. So we went to Japan and we wanted to make a short movie about kintsugi, which is absolutely nonsense, because you can't display the richness of this art in a short movie, right? It's not possible.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. So the kintsugi master we met, like, this was a nice, I think it's really nice to tell that story. It's untold yet. We met this kintsugi master. Well, he said, like, how much time do you have, guys? We said, like, oh, we have 2 weeks. We're in Japan. 2 weeks. It's amazing. And he must, I mean, this is also the way maybe sometimes, you know, wise Japanese people are. He smiled maybe mostly internally at us. Like thinking, you fools, you can think you can document the entire process in 2 weeks, which you find, you Western guys, you find this is a lot of time. So because I knew that, because I assumed that you are a little bit naive for that, I've prepared 3 cups that almost look identically the same. Almost look the same, they're not identical. In 3 different phases, so we can do the filming over in the course of 2 weeks. Otherwise, it would not have been possible. So this was my first step, you know, stepping into it. And then what I think the lesson I learned is that most of the time, the kintsugi piece, it is not worked on, but it stays in a cupboard in a certain amount of humidity and so on. And it has to rest most of the time of the repair process. The cup has to rest. So let's say 80%. And I wasn't aware of that, you know. So sometimes the repair process can take 1/2 year, it can take 2 years, right? And there's so much diligence, so much investigation happening in the kintsugi process. And I think this is something in our world that we have lost a bit, because I can always become faster. And I've seen this from organization. A lot of organizations are now buying AI trainings from us because they want to get their results at better quality and faster, you know. We teach them, right? It's possible. But I would say there's a danger in overlooking some details when it comes to human interaction. And I don't have any answer than just being present and observing, listening, for example, the skill of listening, right? You can become a little bit more effective in listening. You can train listening, of course, all these kinds of active listening, mindful listening, whatever you call it. But there's no way to hack your attention. There's no way to hack your quality of presence. I don't think we can hack that as human beings. You know, there's no shortcut for that. This is where Kintsugi invites you to look at your strengths, you know, but also your cracks. Where are you in your leadership journey when you're serving someone? And so it's not just, you know, become a little bit more mindful, 2% more mindful, 2% more happier. It's not that, you know, it's like, if you really step into it, it's, oh, I really have to fully embrace that. There is no, I would say, light version of Kintsugi. There are some traps. If you go now online and look for Kintsugi cups, there are some Kintsugi cups which you can buy, which are already made golden. They are already finished. They look like a Kintsugi cup, but they have never been broken. And I think this just displays the idea of how we sometimes want to use this shortcut. You know, no breakage. I just buy something that symbolizes Kintsugi. And I think this is like the danger with Kintsugi and a lot of times with Japanese philosophies, that they think we have a shortcut, same to purpose and Ikigai, for example. Mm-hmm. And so if you really dig deeply into Kintsugi, you can find something that for you as leaders that can give you a wider perspective and even some tools, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Isn't it interesting what you're saying? I mean, we know instinctively that there isn't a shortcut to our own development, right? I mean, it's a lifelong process of uncovering, unlearning, learning, noticing. I have a wonderful colleague that says, you know, notice what you're noticing about yourself. And even that, just the stuff that you are picking up on says something, the stuff that you're zooming in on. I know that many of the people listening around the world to this conversation are people who are incredibly passionate about some very complex, sometimes hard causes. Sometimes, I mean, I don't think it's extreme to say life or death causes, that they put themselves on the line, that they hold extremely high standards for themselves, that they're willing to sacrifice themselves. I was struck by what you just said, that most of the repair process, the cup has to rest. Mm-hmm. 80% of the time over 2 years, the cup has to rest. And, you know, this relationship between our standards, what we want to achieve in the world, the thing we hold ourselves to, the thing that sometimes our organizations hold us to, or our families hold us to, and the time we need to achieve it reasonably, and the time we need to repair and restore and heal. It's not an easy thing, is it? It's not easy to figure out that balance. In fact, and I'm using air quotes for those of you who are listening, and not seeing this conversation. The idea of balance, I guess, is a flawed one. I think my question is, how do you hold your standards lightly as a leader? And how do you create space in different times of your life for what is really needed for you, while still being deeply invested in whatever cause you're trying to pursue? Because most of our listeners are not people interested in making $1 million. They're not in corporate careers for the money. They're really there with their hearts.
Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to let go of your standards then when there's so much at stake. And to make time for yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, if we're talking to these kind of, you know, leaders which you just named, who aren't like primarily after money and career success in the classical way, I have to think of, I still do a lot of mentorship to, you know, social business, and they did some studies on entrepreneurship. And for years I looked into social impact, because I was myself a social impact founder, I would say. And I think for years there was this idea that, you know, as social impact founders, you know, we have this purpose, so we will have more resilience, more grit, more endurance, right? But then years later, we had a lot of studies that like we are the most, we have the risk to burn out because we're so, you know, we're so attached to this purpose of changing the world, you know, doing our contribution. So there's also a danger when you are really investing your life and everything into social impact. You know, now these days we have really this, like sometimes it's also a great thing to have some distance to whatever you're pursuing. And so I think resilience, you know, all these things, they don't come with a shortcut. And I like the idea of polarities, you know, you have some lightness in your life, you know, but also you have some depth. This is also where Kintsugi invites you. You have a lot of activity as a leader. You have to be present. As a founder, you want to get things moving, right? You want to push things forward. But also, do you need this quality of stillness and this quality of a pause in your life? Also asking this for your people, you know? Yeah. And maybe you are the one who is driving all this, but then look at your people. And sometimes if I go to social impact startups, they're all like, well, sometimes in the first hour of, you know, having a talk, sometimes people cry because they feel so much pressure. Because this pressure is, you know, this world is in danger. We're doing one tiny thing on, you know, changing this course. But it's also like a lot of pressure, which you take home with, which you get, you know, take home in your dreams when you're sleeping. You wake up, you think of that cause, you know, and so there's a lot of pressure. And I think pressure, you know, this is the idea of anti-fragility, right? Too much pressure on a fragile thing can break the thing. And this idea of ceramics and, you know, porcelain, this ceramics, they can just break so easily, you know, because they're so fragile. And I think we as a leader, we also have our gestalt, we have our capacity, we have literally our body, mind, and soul. And maybe not always, but from time to time, we should really investigate where are we in our journey. It's also the idea of every 10 years, you come into a crisis, and this crisis is just an invitation to, you know, come to maybe the next level of whatever your growth path is. And maybe just adding this, I'm really careful with acronyms and using no traditional words, but with Kintsugi, we try to look at Kintsugi and each letter has now a meaning for us. And I, so Kintsugi, the first I is investigation. So really investigation of yourself and of course of your leadership context. If I start with the K, it's kindness or care from the old Proto-Germanic word karu, where we know names like Kara or Care from, you know, really this also self-kindness, applying the self-kindness and investigating really honestly, radically, what's going on here. Because as I said, it's not fun to look at your scars. It's not fun to look at what has been broken. And sometimes as leader, we also do harm to others, right? We are not perfect. And being really honest about that could lead into some idea of how I want to live leadership. Not silver lining anything, it's not letting slide anything, but really being brutal honest also with myself. And then also towards the people I lead or I'm into business. Makes sense for you?
Yeah, I'm interested to know what the other letters stand for.
Okay. I knew you were going to ask that.
I've got kindness. I've got investigation.
Yeah. Let's go through it. It's nice. I haven't done this, or in English especially. And N is noticing. So after investigation, really noticing. So if you see maybe a short movie or a longer documentation about Kintsugi, you will see there's a lot of, I would even say, strategic thinking into it. You know, it's sometimes not really easy to repair these things who have broken into hundreds of, you know, pieces. And then noticing like really the fractures. Yeah. So this is the N. And then the next one would be the T, right? And T, we weren't sure about it, but I decided to that it is touch. Because if you look at the research of trauma, one of the most effective ways to heal whatever kind of you need healing is actually something that is forbidden in therapy is touch. And it's the most effective way. That's why Bessel van der Kolk says like yoga and everything that is like physical is a way to, you know, to heal. Yeah. Because it's a process of you feeling yourself, you like experiencing your body, your physiological, but also your mind in action. And of course, if we think of anything that if the child, you know, has some harm, we tend to, you know, embrace them and to touch and really to get into touch what is broken is the question. So with yourself, but also if you think of the collective, you know, to really get your hands on it in a kind way, you know. So this would be the T. And the S then would be solitude and silence. So I think there's something that develops into silence. I'm a fan of Henry Nouwen. I quote him often when it comes to listening. But he said something beautiful around silence, that silence is the fertile ground for growth. Sometimes exploring this quality of silence and being with yourself, you know, but not in terms of loneliness, in terms of solitude and finding peace in that state. And in the Kintsugi process, this cup has to sit with itself for a long time so that all the things can harden and become really strong again. Silence and solitude. So, and then just U, which we can say utensil. We saw this like the tools that you have, utensils. It's also another U. It's called urushi, which is the legwork that is applied that the things can become hardened again. So it's kind of the glue. It's not the gold. A lot of people think it's gold that mends the pieces, but it's only gold on the outside. And it's this urushi legwork, which comes from the urushi tree. The interesting thing is, it's super poisonous. So the urushi legwork is super poisonous. You even have to wear masks normally. As you know, if we weren't prepared, you would do a real Kintsugi workshop, you have to wear masks. Because it's like acid. Really goes into our breathing system. We can really burn our hands. So the thing that actually heals and repairs the thing by itself can be really poisonous. Yeah. But when it's harder and stronger while it has to rest, right? It becomes like concrete. It's not really super solid. And then of course, G stands for gold. And really being honest, but also really showing, not I mean in a proud way, but maybe in a way I don't have anything to hide. And actually these scars made me who I am. It's not the successes, the accomplishments. But the scars, they deserve, because I did so much work. I did so much work on the peace, on what has been broken. Well, maybe we as a collective did so much work. It's like honoring that. And the last I would be intention. So what's possible now? I'm interested to how this resonates with you, because as I said, I'm always careful with these acronyms, but does it make sense to you?
That makes sense to me. I think some of the ones that immediately jump out at me is investigation and the first one that you mentioned, because I think we are so quick to jump to conclusion that the investigation part is uncomfortable. We're perhaps quick to get to a remedy and quick to getting to the fixing part so that all can be well again. And perhaps underlying that is a genuine sense of being uncomfortable with the process of being broken and the process of figuring out what really is at stake. And sometimes it's maybe not nice to lift up the hood of ourselves, you know, and to delve there where we don't like to go, where it's dark and unexplored, and perhaps we've put things away, not even just in ourselves, but in our relationships, the parts of relationships that we don't want to talk about, that we don't want to investigate, that we want to just paint over. And then to me, this just idea of
a false fix almost in a relationship, that you can have a broken teacup and you can try to put it together very quickly and maybe use, you know, the wrong glue or some quick fix to try and put it together. And perhaps at the surface of it, it will look the same as a teacup that has been properly fixed, maybe without the beautiful gold. But is it as strong? Is it as meaningful? Does it have a new life to it again if it hasn't taken the proper time of investigation, touch, figuring out what is wrong, then fixing by going through the very poisonous stuff, the very potentially harmful things to get to the other point where we can finally put a piece of gold on it and then celebrate the thing that has cracked that now together makes it whole.
Yeah, I love it. It resonates very on a surprisingly deep level with me. Yeah. Marika, what about you?
I mean, I think it's beautiful and there's so much to take from this. I was wondering, Motok, if we're talking now to the leaders who are building organizations out there in the world, should they be building organizations that are unbreakable, or should they be cultivating the skills to repair? What do you think?
It's an invitation to say, no, please don't build the idea of unbreakable organizations, like robust organizations, right? And I mean, early in the days, we even had this HRO, the highly resilient organization, and they were never meant to be super robust because always there can happen something, you know? Like at that day, these days, it were highly critical organizations like hospitals or whatever, you know? And you can always have an intrusion. These days, like you can have like, you know, digital things happen to you, you know, like a whole system breakdown or so. And I love the idea of anti-fragility. I do teach on that. And like sometimes even intentionally exposing your team or your organization with like really the idea of what would happen if I wouldn't be here tomorrow. What would happen if that happens to us as a system, as a team, you know? And then see what things do you have in place. And it's more than a little bit of a risk assessment. It's like really putting the things that you nobody wants to think on the table, even playing them through. You know, what happens to my agency if I'm not there tomorrow? Do they have access to whether it's my stuff I would have been working on or whatever? You know, is there redundancy and so on? But also, I think this is Kintsugi, what would happen to the organization, to the people, to, you know, to our purpose, you know, to the more human factors as well. And I think for that, you can be very intentional in breaking this kind of anti-fragile organizations. I think there's a path. But for the moment where you are doing whatever you are working on at the right moment, you can apply so many, I think, aspects, qualities of Kintsugi right now. So are you jumping from meeting to meeting? How do you start your all hands, right? Yeah, you're starting all hands, like with a lot of engagement, with a lot of talking. So where's the pause? Where's the quality of the pause? Like by sitting by whatever is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And as I know that you guys are into facilitation, I experience this sometimes by facilitation, you know, when something happens that is not on the agenda, how do you react to that? Recently, I had a literally board member crying in our hall. And I intentionally, but also, to be honest, I didn't know what to do at the first. And then he just waited and, you know, allowed this uncomfortable moment. And everyone later on said, Motoki, this was so valuable that you didn't say anything, that you didn't try to fix anything, that you didn't went to the next agenda part. We had some space to experience this uncomfortable truth. And then really, not always trying to solve. I think this, Clinton, what you also went to, right? Not to silver line, not to fix. I'm a lot of times, as an entrepreneur, I'm into fixing things, right? I see a process, I want to fix that or improve that. And then if I look at my personal life and my daughter says something uncomfortable to me, I want to fix that immediately. Mm-hmm. I want to offer a solution. But am I really in investigating what is truly of service right now? And that could be just shut up and just be present to them. Maybe that's enough. Maybe she just wants to share. The same can I think we can think of teams, teams behavior, teams communication. Yeah.
Fintan and I teach a program called the New School of Facilitation, and one of the frameworks we share in the school is called the Four Quadrants of Gathering Design, which I think is actually very much applicable to anything you do in life, not just designing a gathering. But the fourth quadrant is the reflection, evaluation, appreciation, assessing, kind of what happens after something has taken place, essentially. I would add there something like repair happens there. Trust breakdowns would likely be addressed there. And I can say with confidence now, for the years that we've taught this framework, 100% of the times, this is the quadrant that individuals and organizations spend the least amount of time in. I am yet to encounter an individual leader or an organization that routinely enjoys repairing, reflecting, appreciating, evaluating. And when they spend time there, it's because they're mandated to do so. It's a tick box exercise that the auditors require. You know, have you written a report about whatever you've done in your organization? It's not a let me look at what happened at, in the relationships when we were in this process and have a conversation about the breakdowns that we experienced. And I worry about that. I worry about that deeply because I see it, the same exercise playing out almost monthly in my work. And I see the state of organizations facing an increasingly volatile world where breakdowns happen more than it ever has, where the anti-fragility, the robustness, the resilience of organizations are put to a stress test almost on a daily level, on an hourly level, in almost every way you can imagine. It feels to me, Motoki, and I just want to hear what you think about this, whether you agree that this is, in a way, the next frontier of leadership, is not just, as you say, jumping to solutions mode, fixing the processes, making something look nice again, but cultivating this ability to do deep repair of relationship. And that does not always have to be negative, right? It's also sometimes appreciating people, noticing that which is going well and saying it, spending time there as a way to cultivate the ability of the organization to continue. Does that resonate at all? And if so, how do we get leaders to go there? Because my feeling is that they're so tired of whatever has happened, you know, the election campaign, or this massive project, change project that they've implemented in the organization, or this huge event that they're organizing, that by the time that's done, they just never want to think about it again. And then you're almost surprised when that colleague who you had this massive fight with, like you struggle to connect with them or work with them ever again. And so the cracks show, but they're never repaired.
I super resonate with that, what you both have said. And ask me if this is the next phase. I would say I have some data which is not in my hands, which is more objectively empirical data. And I have my personal data, which is, of course, totally biased. But whenever I come to a team, you know, I just recently we had feedback from a team. They said, like, you know, for 10 years, they've been together really a long time. And of course, there were some changes, but, you know, we had every year we had this retreat 2 days. Every year we learned some interesting method. Every year we wrote a ton of sticky notes, but we didn't see a change happening. And now I was with some colleague, you know, you guys came and it felt like there's no agenda. And for the first time, we connected on a human level, like on this being level. And this was like transformational. This is what people tell me, you know, because we could talk about, you know, all our flaws and all the things that make us entirely a human being here. And we're human beings. Like, so there's sometimes these simple, like, you know, truths appear, like, we're human beings at work. Yes, absolutely. And so this is like, I hear this a lot. But also on the, if I look at the, you know, societal data or at the data coming from work, health and culture, you know, I see this, like, for years, we learned a lot of methods, whether it's into, you know, how to give feedback, you know, how to do agile and so on. But I get to so many teams, they said, like, I'm so tired of tools and methods. I'm just so tired of it. You know, even puts more things on my shoulder. And when I heard like the story of Kintsugi, or the same as with Ikigai, he didn't present the next framework, but this was an invitation to just be myself and really be brutally honest about that. And I think this is a great starting point. I think this could be the do for every team that can build whatever you try to build. And I think this is like truly a leadership call. It's totally up to everybody how to decide on that call, right? Because we don't have the answers. Like Clinton and I, we are in Germany. Like at the moment, next to me is Volkswagen. You know, they have so many questions, more questions than answers. You know, so we have all these breakage on a collective, on a societal level, and even on a planetarian level, right? But it all comes back to me reading the news, me being in an empathetic response with my neighbor, you know. And just one of my neighbor, he's a professional soccer player, and they intended to have a big Christmas party with the fans tomorrow morning. But yesterday the news came that one of their employees of the professional soccer club just died in an accident. So they have to cancel everything. But this was the appropriate answer, I would say. They now will take a pause. They said, we can't even react on social media at the moment. We have to pause here. No. And I think everyone is really in remedy and is into mourning. But also everyone is faced with their own fragility of their lives, right? It's a reminder always to how fragile our lives are. And I would say it's, maybe this is a famous quote from someone I can't recall, but it's in the reaction, you know, where we show the ability and show the quality on how deeply we are connected or not, right? Yeah. Just trying me to just give an answer. It makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you.
You were touching now also on kind of, I mean, we've spoken about the personal and we've spoken about kind of at a team organizational interpersonal level. There's also the societal level where perhaps some people are noticing cracks in society. Mm-hmm. Increased polarization, you know, us versus them. It feels so politically charged in the world. And I mean, I'm trying to also not read too much of it in it from my own perspective, because I only have my own perspective. Can't step out of myself. But I find myself incredibly tinted, almost looking at the world through this tinted lens of, you know, what is your opinion on something? And does that allow me to connect with you or not? And if we don't have the same opinion, then I struggle to connect with you. I think many people, especially at the end of year period where families come together traditionally, many people are confronted with the societal cracks playing out at a family level. We disagree politically on what the state of the world is and what direction it should go. And so therefore, it perhaps forms a crack or it exacerbates a crack that already exists. We suspect each other from malintention. We don't think we want the best for each other, or we disagree so fundamentally about the direction of the world that we're unable to repair at a personal level because of a societal crack. And I'm wondering what your thoughts or your reflections are about repairing seeming societal cracks. When
the world itself feels so fragile. I mean, just earlier this week, you know, the Assad regime overnight fell apart, something that people did not expect to happen. That too is a form of fragility, I suppose, change that just happens so instantly, and then suddenly a new reality is with us, whether for, you know, for better or for worse. We now have to deal with this reality. I don't know. There's a lot going on in my mind. And I'd just love to hear your thoughts about that, about the, I suppose, at a societal level, the fragility of the world, the cracks that we see, and how we repair that those cracks at that level.
Absolutely. I mean, this is me more dreaming of a new reality. I would wish, I hope it's possible. And I mean, what is my evidence, or what gives me hope, is if I look at reconciliation processes like Desmond Tutu, you know, brought into this world, like the fourfold process of reconciliation, right? So it is possible, even in circumstances where I wouldn't have any idea that, is it possible? And how should we do that? And the same thing is like when you mentioned the fall of the Assad regime, like our country is already responding to that. You know, how we, you know, drive our politics in terms of refugee, you know, coming from Syria, or, you know, and there are already thoughts like in terms of solutionism. We all already want to, where's the pause here? You know, you don't see that happen. This sounds more like a complaint, but if you talk about the societal level, I would say it just becomes so big that I have to come back to what is in my hands. So literally in terms of the pottery of the brokenness. And my idea would be if everyone would really come back to that, and this is my piece, and this is my gift, my honoring me, the breakage, but also this is the part of, you know, when we try to fix things, this is my part I'm contributing with. I don't have in my hands, it's just too big, the whole thing anymore. You know, with a single cup, I can do that. If I'm a Kintsugi master, I can do that. But if it comes to the bigger collective, I don't have everything in my hands. And this builds like something I think beautiful. I personally, I'm dependent. No, maybe Clinton, you have a completely different political opinion, but here we are both having our little piece of that thing. And we're trying to bring this, you know, to one idea of, we have to repair the status quo. Otherwise we won't go anywhere with our opinions. Right. Maybe sometimes on a group level, we can see these things happening. I have absolutely my doubts in terms of political things at the moment. I think even in the US, we have some authorities, when you mention Christmas, they recommend not to talk about politics on the Christmas table. Right. Just don't talk about it, you know? And then there are all these jokes about, you know, what to eat. Even eating is a political decision. Mm. Everything's a political decision these days, right? So how do we do that? And I think having the openness, the quality of a discourse in terms of what are the narratives that are coming together, what is your story? I think this was also Desmond Tutu's idea of reconciliation. The first thing is telling your story. What that does mean is like everyone else is listening, right? So the quality of, you know, allowing the story, not reacting to that, listening to that story, and then you get the opportunity to tell your story. Right? And everyone else is listening. I think this could be my kind of dream as a sort of an answer to that.
Yeah, I love that. I love the links with Desmond Tutu. You know, that he also spoke about it. It starts with, you know, telling the truth, your perspective, but the truth without the necessary steps for repair is also empty. That it requires action to be taken, so to set it right, that which needs to be set right. I think there's a lesson in there for leaders as well. The pause when something breaks, the pause, bringing the curiosity to investigate first what is going on, hearing the different pieces, looking at the different pieces on the table before we can consider thoughtfully and with intention how to put this back together. In our way.
And if I may add to that,
of course,
if you now have the Kintsugi acronym and you work yourself like through it, I think there's even a deeper layer of, you know, many layers of acceptance. Because what you just said, like accepting, you know, that I think this is always the first thing, whether it comes to resilience, like the first pillar is acceptance, whether it comes to trauma work or reconciliation work. And yes, I found it so interesting with Kintsugi, there are so many layers of acceptance. Acceptance of it is broken. Acceptance of maybe I don't have an idea yet how to repair these things. Acceptance of maybe I need help here. Maybe I need support, even as a leader, you know, I need support. Not knowing how long this will take. I don't know how long this will take. Yeah. First doing the investigation and then so on. So you will have like a multi-layer invitation to accept and not accept. And I think acceptance asks so much from us. So there's all, again, the inner work. It's hard for me to accept things in my life if I'm not really aligned with, you know, what is my status quo. Much more easy to invite the unfinished business and the flaws and all these if I have enough, let's say, self-awareness. And I'm at least with some points in my life, I'm quite self-confident. But there are a lot of parts I'm not sure about Motoki and the idea on how I approach the world. I'm still finding out this with 51. But I try to be honest about it. I think this is my language. And I think the people around me know that I'm, I consider myself as a person with a lot of cracks and scars. So.
That's beautiful. It's that, what you said, you know, the scars made me who I am, wearing your gold proudly, so to speak, not in a flaunting way, but in a acceptance way. It strikes me that Kintsugi might be interpreted as a reactionary practice or like a reactionary way of thinking. Something has happened, it's broken, now we react to it and we repair. Are there lessons that you think leaders can draw from Kintsugi that not only set them up to just counter the negativity, counter that which has broken, but to create a sense of proactive hope or proactive action?
I think a lot of people find Kintsugi close to the idea of wabi-sabi, you know, that we find beauty in every, even in things that are not perfect. And then we come to the, maybe to the idea that we don't live in a perfect world. And the same is with us humans. And I think this is a starting point for every conversation and engagement you have. Whether you're doing your yearly, you know, like, or feedback session with a person, right? And and also being, maybe also coming where we started, you know, with the quality of hospitality, more inviting people to this room of, you know, it's unfinished business. There are flaws, you know, this is not perfect, you know. But that's also our call for leadership. And we're all leaders here. So let's work with that, you know. So it's not only, as you said, it's a lot of reaction to what has been broken, but it's constantly there. So Kintsugi can be also, if you really live philosophical, it's not a status that you reach, but it's more a process and it's an ongoing process. And I think there's always a breakage, you know.
It feels like a beautiful place to end the conversation on the note of hope, but I suppose an invitation to continued commitment to curiosity, inward curiosity for yourself, and an acceptance to that there will be breakage and yet there is also repair that is available to us as a resource. And I love that idea. Marika, was there anything you wanted to say as we close this conversation? Or Motoki, you as well?
I was just struck. The thought that kept on coming up for me when you both were thinking together was how acceptance and pause and silence is not passive.
Mm.
It's not, oh, I accept that this world is happening to me and this is just the way it is. And it's an intentional choice. There's choicefulness. I'm hesitant to use the word action because I think that takes us again back into the something you have to do realm, right? But it's not passive. You're not a victim. There's a massive degree of choicefulness in taking a pause. Yeah. Thank you, Motoki, for having this rich conversation with us.
Yeah. From my side as well.
Yeah. I really feel touched about that as well. Like myself, that's why I don't watch the Kintsugi movie like every day, or I talk about it every day, because I want to keep it like something special in my life. But for anyone who likes to get a little bit, let's say, practical, I would say I just have this idea of an invitation to allow yourself, if you listen to this, the pause. It can be kind of an active pause, you know, then whether you see the documentary we shot, it's called The Art of Kintsugi, or there's a theologian and an artist who I really admire, Makoto Fujimura, who talks about Kintsugi from a perspective of an artist. And whether you take 3 minutes, 4 minutes of time, or, you know, you see a documentary on Kintsugi, and then really noticing like this end, like noticing what emotions comes up for you, and just really noticing and allowing that. I think this could be like a practical thing after listening to this podcast episode, and being like really truthful about that, whatever comes up to you. And I think this is a nice starting point after this conversation, maybe.
Yeah, that's beautiful for those who are listening right now to literally hit the pause button right now and just take a few seconds, take a few breaths, and ask yourself, how are you feeling right now after this conversation, having listened to it? Where is the opportunity for pause for you in this moment? Motoki, a deep sense of appreciation. I'm sure I speak for Marika as well, from both of us, for making time in a busy period and to do so with so much ease in the conversation. I appreciate it. I thank you for it. And I will definitely take you up on that tea ceremony invitation. I don't let invitations like that slide. I'm very interested to know which teacup you have chosen for me. You have some months to prepare.
And I'm already thinking of one. It's right there. I noticed it. I hope it will not fall down or break. Until then, I will be very careful and diligent about that.
Otherwise, I can only come in 2 years' time to have that teacup. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the invitation. And it was just a beautiful space that I stepped into it. I'm so thankful that you also give room for the topic of Kintsugi. And yeah, I hope that your listeners will dive into that, wherever this will lead them. Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure they will. We'll be sharing some of the books and the resources that came up in this conversation. We'll also share in the show notes. As always, a big thank you also to the IAF that enabled this conversation today. As you know, it forms part of the IAF podcast series that accompanies regular seminar programs of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach in Germany. Feel free to listen to other episodes and share your thoughts in response, and to keep an eye on the work of the IAF and its various social media channels. If you appreciate the content like this, there's more where this came from. Until next time.